content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the December 2018 edition of Smithsonian Magazine, which is the annual spotlight on the Genius of America, the 2018 American Ingenuity Awards. This section highlights different individuals and people that have won the awards over the year, the dazzling new ideas changing our world. The introduction to this section begins. Genius without education is like silver in the mine, Benjamin Franklin proclaimed. In 1750, the same year America's founding innovator printed this bit of wisdom in Poor Richard's Almanac, he shocked himself senseless while trying to electrocute his Christmas turkey in the errant belief that it would tenderize the bird. But he continued his education, publishing his famous kite experiment less than 2 years later. Persistence. That bedrock national virtue is well known to all the recipients of the 2018 Smithsonian American Ingenuity Awards. Janelle Monáe spent years, between film acting roles and other musical projects, developing Dirty Computer, a dazzling emotional picture that dares to imagine a startlingly bleak future of robotic gains and human losses. Who epitomizes the innovator's need for drive better than the engineers at Waymo, 10 million miles into their quest to perfect an autonomous driverless car, or Scott Bolton, whose Juno probe traveled nearly 2 billion miles before settling into its current orbit around Jupiter? No field of endeavor would have seemed less susceptible to invention than history, by definition. But watch the actor and comedian John Leguizamo shatter that expectation in a hilarious stage performance, which is, like all the bold American inventions presented here, electrifying. For physical sciences, Scott Bolton won the award for the Juno mission. This article is by Robert I. Ryan. A visionary NASA mission to Jupiter takes on a giant mystery to understand our own planet's origins, unlocking the solar system. Jupiter guards secrets about the early solar system, says Scott Bolton, standing in the cavernous and dimly lit mission control room at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. It grabbed most of the leftovers after the sun formed, when we want to go back and try to understand how the planets were made, where the stuff that made us came from. Jupiter represents the first step. Bolton is the lead designer and principal investigator for NASA's Juno spacecraft, currently looping around Jupiter after traveling nearly 2 billion miles. The mission's goal is to understand the planet's structure and the amount of water it contains. The results could yield rich new insights into how planets are born and how water appeared on Earth. Bolton's unorthodox proposal got critical feedback at first. Earlier missions to the outer solar system were nuclear-powered, but Bolton's team designed Juno to run on solar energy. To protect the spacecraft from Jupiter's radiation, the throat of hell in our solar system, in Bolton's words, they created an armored vault with more than 400 pounds of titanium and crammed in the delicate circuitry Bolton called Juno's central brain. To limit the most intense exposure at the equator, Bolton's team designed an elliptical orbit that races from the North Pole to the South Pole in just 2 hours and then ducks below the high radiation belt. At its closest approach, Juno is a mere 3,000 miles above the planet's cloud tops. For the rest of its 53-day loop, the spacecraft cruises millions of miles away from the planet. Most radically, Bolton came up with a new way to solve the major puzzle left by the Galileo probe. That earlier mission to Jupiter had dropped a localized probe, which meant it may have sampled a particularly dry spot and missed more abundant water elsewhere. This time, instead of just measuring specific locations, Bolton thought of using microwave radiometers to estimate the water everywhere on Jupiter. The idea was so novel that Bolton's team had to design a new instrument and plan a very different type of mission around this new kind of measurement. "I have always had a little element of me that was a rebel," Bolton says wryly. "I rarely did something because people said it was the way we always did it." Bolton's fascination with space emerged in the Apollo era. He was born in 1958, the same year as NASA. He and his pals in the Detroit suburbs watched Star Trek. "I wanted to be on the Enterprise," he says. And he joined a club where he received new science fiction books each month. In the late 1970s, when he was studying aerospace engineering at the University of Michigan, a speaker from JPL showed the class glorious image of Jupiter from the recently launched Voyager mission. "I was totally amazed," recalls Bolton. During his senior year, he was hired by JPL, where he would work on the Galileo mission before completing a PhD in astrophysics at the University of California, Berkeley. Juno is only halfway through its planned lifetime. It's scheduled to dive into the planet in 2021, but it has already upended much of the accepted wisdom. "I'm in total wonder that we could have been so wrong," Bolton says. Scientists expected the planet's fast rotation and whirling winds to mix all its gases into a uniform blend. Instead, they have found that its colored bands and long-lasting storms, such as the Great Red Spot, have roots of ammonia and water that extend hundreds of miles deep. At the North and South Poles, scientists were amazed to find cyclones packed like cinnamon buns, 6 at the North Pole, 9 at the South, all spinning the same direction. They also found that Jupiter's magnetic field is about twice as strong as scientists expected. And unlike Earth's magnetic field, which arises from our planet's core, Jupiter's is surprisingly uneven between its poles. Bolton and others guess that just below the atmosphere, hydrogen is behaving like a metal, sparking part of Jupiter's magnetism. Clues like this will lead to a better understanding of how planets form. Bolton, who is also an associate vice president of the nonprofit Southwest Research Institute, oversees the Juno scientists who gather, as well as the engineers who control the spacecraft. "He's been an outstanding leader, and it's not an easy job," says David Stevenson, a senior Caltech theorist who has witnessed decades of solar system exploration. "He has this wonderful combination of leadership and scientific knowledge that motivates the mission." Bolton has also involved the public in groundbreaking ways. Juno's website publishes raw images for citizen scientists to crop, color correct, and collage. Bolton's friends in the music industry, ranging from the industrial musician Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails to the Greek composer Vangelis, have also boosted Juno's popular appeal, creating Juno-related songs and film scores. It's a Renaissance approach Bolton finds deeply rewarding. After all, he points out, Galileo was an accomplished lute player before he observed Jupiter's major moons. 3 of those satellites have 1, 2, 4 harmonics. Every time Ganymede orbits Jupiter, Europa orbits twice and Io 4 times. Juno's camera captured the celestial resonance for the first time and presented it to the public in a time-lapse video that's been viewed more than 2 million times. "The innovation comes from the combination of analytic and creative thought," Bolton says. "You couldn't do Juno unless you had both halves of that." Next, we'll move on to the youth that won the award, March for Our Lives Student Activists. Fighting for Their Lives by Maggie Jones. After the violence at a Florida high school, brave students showed us how to find meaning in tragedy. The most powerful American youth movement in decades was launched on February 14th, Valentine's Day, in the hours after a 19-year-old gunman armed with a semi-automatic rifle walked through the doors at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and for 6 long minutes shot at students and staff, massacring 17 of them. David Hogg, a senior, heard the gunshots while sitting in AP Environmental Science. Jacqueline Corrin, a junior, who would learn the next morning that her friend Jamie Gutenberg was killed, missed the gunman at the entrance by minutes. She was back in study hall when the fire alarm went off. When her best friend told her she'd heard gunfire, they ran to a classroom and waited, shaking in the dark before a SWAT team finally arrived. Senior Emma Gonzalez spent hours locked inside a locked-down auditorium, while Hogg hid with others inside a classroom closet, where he turned his cell phone camera on himself. In a video that went viral, he made an urgent plea. "I call on the legislators of this country to take action and stop this from happening," he said. "Forget the NRA, forget all the political backing. Take a stance for human lives, for children's lives." Of the remarkable qualities displayed by the 20-some founding members of March for Our Lives, as the movement created after the killing became known, one of the savviest was intuiting nearly instantly the time was not on their side. That very first night, after the assailant was arrested off campus and the school had been cleared, Hogg found a news truck and gave his first interview on national TV. On Instagram, Corin urged her already growing follower base to contact their elected officials and demand stricter gun control laws. Cameron Caskey, a fast-talking theater student, quickly came up with the hashtag, #NeverAgain, which she shared on Facebook and Twitter. "He refused to let the media turn the murders into one more dog and pony show," he told me recently, filled with images of weeping survivors. Over the coming days, Caskey and a growing band of Parkland students, mostly of them juniors and seniors, gathered at Caskey's house and strategized about a mission, starting with a demand for stricter background checks for gun buyers. The students gamed out how to use social media to their advantage. Anyone who didn't have a Twitter account made one, and the students soon became adept at creating memes and quips to call out the National Rifle Association and NRA-backed politicians. And they decided that their movement would be premised on a nonpartisan message of common-sense gun control reform. "If we start endorsing Democrats," Caskey told me, "it implies only Democrats can pass these laws." Among those in Caskey's living room was Corin, the class president for 2 years, who had been coping by doing what she did best, organizing. She hatched plans for a 100-student bus trip to Florida's state capital to lobby legislators about gun control. At a rally in Fort Lauderdale, Gonzalez, whose raw intensity, anger, and tears would make her the movement's public face and its heart, gave her iconic "We Call BS" speech. On CBS's Face the Nation, the group, now including Gonzalez and Hogg, announced plans for a mass demonstration in Washington, D.C., the following month to rally for stricter gun control laws. It had been 4 days since the massacre. "We were going 93 million miles an hour," Gonzalez told me recently of those early weeks. "We never wanted a break. We never wanted to wait." That speed and intensity paid off. Only 5 weeks after the shooting, the March for Our Lives rally in Washington drew up to 800,000 people and inspired sister marches in 800 cities around the globe. After that, no one could have blamed the students if they had wanted to step back. They'd done more than their share. And because the movement had turned them into public figures, they had to withstand attacks from some NRA supporters, as well as right-wing pundits and politicians. Meanwhile, they still had high school to finish. They had their lives to piece back together, college on the horizon. Instead, founders including Corin Hogg, Jamal Lemmy, and brothers Matt and Ryan Dietst dreamed up a nationwide bus tour, inspired in part by the 1964 Freedom Summer, when student volunteers fanned out across Mississippi to register African-American voters. In this case, in addition to registering voters, they connect with other young activists to promote the movement's broadening agenda, which now includes 10 specific policy goals, from banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines to funding gun violence research, which has been blocked since 1996 after lobbying by the NRA and others. This summer's Road to Change tour lasted 2 months and included 50 cities. At any given time, about 20 Parkland leaders and student activists from elsewhere traveled together on a white and silver bus, flanked by two black SUVs with security guards. Hogg, in particular, has raised the ire of some fanatics and has received repeated death threats, despite regularly reminding the public that he and the movement support the Second Amendment, and that his father, a former FBI agent, owns a Glock. A separate Florida tour included 25 cities and visited every legislative district in the state. "The bus was the students' safe space," Corin said. "No press allowed." A small group of adults on board included a therapist and publicity and event crews who helped with media, hotel reservations, and other logistics. "Anyone over 20 works for us," Hogg told me one afternoon in Oakland, California. "They are our interns." Every night was a new hotel. Every morning a new agenda with up to 5 events beginning at 9 a.m. and ending after 10 p.m. Town halls with audiences reaching into the thousands. Meetings with youth leaders and victims of gun violence. Rallies, candlelit vigils, plus too much fast food and too little sleep. "If I need to cry, I find half an hour to cry by myself," Gonzalez told me in August, curled up in a chair outside the Lyric Theater in Blacksburg, Virginia. It was not just the pace that got to her, but hearing repeated stories of gun violence. Like Hogg, Gonzalez wore a crowd of memorial bracelets for Parkland victims on her left wrist, underneath her flannel shirt, which she draped backwards like a Snuggie. She had on a straight out of Standing Rock t-shirt. Corin, ever the organizer, ran logistics, connecting with youth leaders at each stop. Hogg, a policy wonk, researched each community's demographics and its history of youth voter turnout and mass shootings. "It's not just for speeches," Hogg told me. "When I talk to people one-on-one, I need to understand the place I'm talking about." Gonzalez brought inspiration, mischievous, and light, including for Hogg, who considered Gonzalez his closest friend on the tour. In a back room at the Lyric Theater, she ruffled Hogg's hair as he sat hunched over his laptop. Later, as Hogg peppered me with facts about the NRA, she walked up to him, put her face a couple inches from his, and burped. The tour showcased the movement's increasing breadth, and a shrewd understanding that in the long run, if the movement hopes to create lasting change, it has to grow beyond its famous founders. "We need to decentralize," Hogg told me. The activists no longer pushed messages only about gun violence in schools, but also gun violence and domestic abuse, police brutality, suicide, and against the LGBTQ community. Along the way, the tour, reflecting the movement's growing diversity, brought on board student activists of color from Harlem to St. Louis, from Houston to Milwaukee, many of whom have since become integral leaders in March for Our Lives. In August, the Pew Charitable Trust published an analysis crediting the group with influencing, quote, "a year of unparalleled success for the gun control movement," unquote, ranging from banning so-called bump stocks to nearly 50 new gun control laws passed in 25 states, including 14 with Republican governors. By tour's end, the students had registered at least 10,000 young voters and met more than 50 youth groups. This fall, ahead of the midterm elections, they helped organize voter registration drives in high schools and colleges nationwide. In October, after publishing a book, Glimmer of Hope, they were back on the road with a final Vote for Our Lives event in Parkland on November 6th, Election Day. March for Our Lives now has more than 60 official chapters, and Corin told me that in 2019 she expects that to grow into the hundreds. One priority will be to reach more middle and even elementary school students. It was no accident that the last rally of the summer tour, the final speaker wasn't Hogg or Gonzalez. Instead, three young activists, including 10-year-old Yolanda Renee King, Martin Luther King Jr.'s granddaughter, stood in front of an audience of 2,000 and spoke about creating political change. Two had to climb onto milk crates to reach the microphone. Gonzalez stood with other March for Our Lives leaders quietly behind them. They were there to remind the audience that, as they like to say, the young people will win. Now on to the award for history. John Leguizamo, Latin History for Morons. Learning to Speak Latino by Neil Genslinger. An uproariously inventive new one-man show puts the story of a neglected culture center stage. Forgive John Leguizamo if he checks his cell phone while dining with you. It's not the usual celebrity self-importance thing. It's that he has so much history crammed into his head that he can't always recall every factoid he's after. He might have to do a quick internet search to pin down the name of, for instance, Josefa Segovia, a Mexican who in 1851 became the first woman lynched in California after killing a man who tried to attack her. Leguizamo's brain wasn't always so overcrowded with the triumphs and tragedies of his forebears. For most of his life, he admits, he didn't know all that much about his heritage. But then he put together Latin History for Morons, a solo performance piece with all his usual outlandish humor, but also crammed with enough real history to make a good start on a textbook. In the show, which opened at the Public Theater in New York before a 5-month run on Broadway, he conducts a saucy tour of 3,000 years of Latin American history, introducing individuals and cultural contributions that probably didn't come up in whatever history classes you took. Latin History for Morons won a special Tony, an accolade not voted on but bestowed directly by a Tony Awards committee, for Leguizamo's solo performance. The show was also nominated for Best Play. From the very start, the response to his material was passionate engagement. A lot of audience members came up to me and said, "What 3 books can I read? Where can I find this information?" He recalled over breakfast at a restaurant near his home in Manhattan's West Village. Lots of people were curious. Even 13-year-old kids were going, "Why isn't this taught in school? What 13-year-old kid do you know wants to be forced to read more?" Leguizamo, who is 54 and was born in Bogota, Colombia, and grew up in Queens, exploded onto the American entertainment scene with Spic-O-Rama and Freak, and other brash solo shows that drew on his experiences as a Latino. His fledgling TV and film career began to take off, 130 roles so far, and now he is fully in the mainstream. His work in the miniseries Waco earned him an Emmy nomination this year. Leguizamo got the idea for Latin History about 6 years ago, when his son Lucas, then in middle school, was being bullied by his classmates because he was Latino. Hoping to make Lucas proud of his heritage, Leguizamo found out that his knowledge of Latino history was incomplete. He even mixed up the name of the South American tribe he's descended from, the Musica, with the language of that tribe, Chibcha, a mistake his son's teacher caught when the boy repeated it. "I had to win his trust back," Leguizamo said, "so I started doing a lot of research to be accurate for my son. That quest became an obsession. Considering all the things that I found out that there were not in any history textbooks, in any Ken Burns Civil War documentary, in any Band of Brothers by Spielberg, in any Discovery Channel show, the huge numbers and the participation and the blood we shed in making of this country, it's wild to me," he said with a combination of perplexity and anger. But turning his obsession, "I love the history," into a show was a trial. The show combines the personal story of his efforts to help his son with a ribald romp through the Latino past, complete with costumes. You should see him as Frida Kahlo. Workshopping the piece at the Berkeley Repertory Theater in California, he kept hearing the same thing: less history, more of the father-son tale. Everybody said, "What we love is the personal side," he said. I go, "No, I really don't want to go into that because it's my son's life, and I really don't want to put that out there." But now, though, he was on a mission, and thus willing to brave a more personal approach. With all the things happening to Latin children in the country, high school dropout rate, I know it's a lack of history and representation in schools that makes us vulnerable. It's a damaging dynamic, and I experienced it. So I was hoping that my show was going to be an antidote. The Incas had the largest empire of the time, bigger than the Ming Dynasty, Tsarist Russia, or any European country. Leguizamo's effort to reach a vastly wider audience also took a leap forward last month after Netflix premiered a version of Latin History, filmed at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark, and a PBS documentary is in the works on the making of the show. He feels strongly that teaching Latin history is the first step toward conquering prejudice, and he dreams of using his research to create a history textbook. And many of the historical figures he encountered, war heroes, activists, victims of injustice, lived lives that seem made for Hollywood. "I'd like to make those movies," he said, "even if I'm not in them." We'll finish today's program with an article from the prologue section titled "Streetwise" by Anna Diamond. "Jazz, Race, and an Unlikely Friendship Inspire Green Book," a new movie about navigating Jim Crow America. It was well after dark on a Saturday night in January 1963 when the Don Shirley Trio took the stage in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. The program of show tunes, jazz, and classical music, the local paper reported, was brilliant and exciting and warmly received by the large crowd. But its famed leader and pianist, John Shirley, who was black, knew his welcome was conditional. A hateful sign stood at Manitowoc city limits: "N-word, don't let the sun go down on you in our town." When the trio set out on another tour later that year, Shirley hired a white driver, a gregarious Italian-American bouncer known as Tony Lip, to handle problems that might arise in the sundown towns of the North and the Jim Crow era South. My father said it was almost on a daily basis that we would get stopped because a white man was driving a black man, recalled Lip's son, Nick Vallelonga, who has turned their journey into Green Book, a new film garnering Oscar buzz. Vallelonga was 5 years old when his father headed out on the road with the pianist. After they returned more than a year later, the men lived their separate lives. Shirley played to acclaim in Europe, and Lip became an actor, but they remained friends. As a child, Vallelonga visited Shirley in his studio in Manhattan and heard stories about their trip. "That's an unbelievable movie," he remembers thinking. "I'm going to make it one day." In his 20s, Vallelonga, an actor and occasional screenwriter, interviewed his father and Shirley about how these two men from starkly different backgrounds navigated the racism they encountered. But Shirley stipulated that he didn't want his story told until after his death. Both men passed away in 2013, and those conversations, along with letters Lip wrote his wife, formed the basis of Green Book, which stars Mahershala Ali as Shirley and Viggo Mortensen as Lip. The title is a reference to the Negro Motorist Green Book, a travel guide for African Americans published from 1936 to 1967 that promised vacation without aggravation. Making the film more than half a century after the events it depicts hasn't muted its powerful message about overcoming prejudice. Lip was a product of his times. Italians lived with Italians. The Irish lived with the Irish. African Americans lived with African Americans. Vallelonga says, "The trip opened my father's eyes and then changed how he treated people." We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.